in this last section, we're dealing with the abrogation of the covenant of works on the part of God. Certain things that are done away with and certain things that are not done away with. We're just making clear ideals and clear distinctions in our mind that way. So this is where we're going to talk about the eternal truths that come as a result of the fall and of sin. Eternal truths is our first heading in this section. Eternal truths that transcend the abrogation of the covenant. Things that continue even though the covenant is broken. Things that don't stop. Now, what can you think about? Just think in terms of the covenant of works for a second. What about the covenant of works continues? That's what this question is dealing with. What things concerning the covenant of works continue? Here's the first one. Perfect obedience. That still continues. Men still have to be perfectly obedient to the covenant of works. Why? What is the reason Adam breaks the covenant? Doesn't the covenant just go away? We're going to talk about that in a minute. That's actually what Arminius believed. What is the reason? Perfect obedience. Yeah, perfect obedience continues because God doesn't change. Now, if you understand that, that helps in a lot of ways in the way that God talks to people. And we'll talk about that in a little bit. But that's Pelagius hated that. Pelagius hated the idea. Why would God tell us to do things that we can't do? You know, be perfect. Well, I can't be perfect. I'm fallen.
Well,
God doesn't really expect that. Augustine understood it. Pelagius hated it. Augustine said, Lord, command what you will, but grant what you command. See, he understood how the fall still works. He commands the same things, but he has to grant to us now because we're fallen, we have wicked hearts, what it is that he does command. Pelagius hated that because they think that he thought, you know, you have a power to be able to do what God says. God says don't sin, so you must have a power to not sin. We'll talk about that in any case. Let's look at the next one. Not only perfect obedience, but in number two, perfect obedience in terms of gaining eternal life. Perfect obedience and gaining eternal life. Galatians 5:3 says this, and I testify again to every man who becomes circumcised that he is a debtor to keep the whole law. That's what he's got to do. That's Galatians 5:3. I testify to every man who becomes circumcised that he's a debtor to keep the whole law. You've got to keep it all. That is what gains you eternal life. Problem is that right out of the chute, you're already fallen. You're already not perfect. So you're done in, even before you get started. And so this is true. This is an eternal truth that continues. You have to have perfect obedience. You have to have perfect obedience to gain eternal life. And what if you don't? What is still the truth if you don't? That's still true. Death. Disobedience is punished by death. That's what happens. Men are still obliged to keep the requirements or face the consequences. Everyone out here is under the covenant of works. And they have to keep the law perfectly. That's what they're going to be judged by. If they don't, they're going to be punished by death. So let's ask this question. Did the fall abrogate the duty to keep the law? No. The fall did not abrogate the duty to keep the law. Strange thing is that Arminius did believe that that was the case. That because Adam broke it, well, it's all done, you know. Sin broke the covenant, therefore obedience is no longer required. Right? That isn't that he can't be. Man has no ability to obey, therefore God doesn't require him to obey. So Arminius got closer than Pelagius did, but he asked the question this way: can love be required from man who is under the curse of God? Can God rightly do that? Can God say, you must love me, even though he's under the curse?
He does.
He does. That is correct. Now we're going to find out why that's the case. This is what people often miss. But you're right. Love is required for those who are still under the curse. So, in answering Arminius, we say a couple of things. The first thing we say is, obligation to obey is founded principally upon God, not a covenant. Do you follow that? Principles to obey, obligations to obey, is found principally upon God and not on covenant. That's when we say the law covenant or the law itself, the law do not eat of the tree, that's a reflection of the character of God. That's a condition of the covenant, but primarily it's a reflection of the character of God. So that doesn't change because God doesn't change. So just because God punishes sin for somebody breaking the law doesn't mean that because he does punish sin that suddenly you don't have to keep the law anymore. That doesn't follow at all. God is going to continue to punish it. He actually administers a greater punishment because we have all this extra light now. We have the word. You know, Jesus says, "Ye shall receive greater damnation as a result." And the inability of somebody because they're incapable, doesn't negate the responsibility to obey. Man was the cause of the inability. That doesn't mean that suddenly God's going to say, oh no, since man fell, I'm going to have to change everything now and work it so that, you know, I can accommodate his fallenness. He doesn't do that. Man's sin can't diminish God's authority because that would be contrary to God's nature. He still has to say the same things in the same way. So to require obedience is exactly what God would have to further do. And what Arminius does is he really makes man to be God, ultimately. Because man will control all of these things. Oh no, man fell. Let me cater to man. Let me change things for man. See, man becomes the center of attention, and man becomes God instead of, in a sense, allowing God to just be God. The law itself is rooted in God's nature. You can't overthrow that. He's always going to be that way. God doesn't change. So the law, if we were to say this, Arminius will put here, Arminius's false conceptions, and answering him, that God doesn't change. And then the reason is the law remains the same as God. The law doesn't change because God doesn't change. Now there's a whole bunch of scriptures that deal with the immutability of God or that God doesn't change. James 1:17 is a good verse. Every good gift and every perfect gift is from above and comes down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shadow of turning. Now, that's kind of an interesting phrase. There's no variation or shadow of turning. James actually uses some very specific words. They're astronomical words. In terms of when the sun is in the sky and the earth rotates, and so there are shadows that are created as a result of the rotation of the earth. It's constantly changing because the earth is constantly rotating. It says with God, there isn't any variation that way. There's no turning that way. There's no shadow that God casts. He is a beam of divine glory that just continues in the very way that it is. There is no change in him. The law doesn't change because God is immutable. Romans 8:4, one of the more famous passages in the New Testament, in chapter 8, that the righteous requirement of the law might be fulfilled in us who do not walk according to the flesh, but according to the Spirit. Now, wait a second. If we do away with the law, and we do away with the covenant because Adam broke it, then there's no reason for the law to be fulfilled in any way. As a consequence, there's no reason for Jesus even to come. If God does away with that, and so suddenly caters to man in some way, then there's no reason for anything to be fulfilled, for Jesus to come. Right? But that's definitely not what's going on. So the reason that the fall doesn't abrogate the duty to keep the law is because God doesn't change. He continues forever in the same way that he always has. He doesn't change at all. And the law then has to be fulfilled. It has to be kept. Let's look at number three. The gospel does not change this at all. In other words, the gospel doesn't abrogate the duty to keep the law. It doesn't. The gospel is the message of keeping the law. It just talks about a different guy who kept it. Instead of Adam, it's Christ. The very fact that a covenant of grace, which we're going to start talking about next week, the very fact that the covenant of grace exists demonstrates the reality that there is a covenant of works that needs to be fulfilled. Perfect obedience is required to obtain eternal life because Christ's life and death was necessary to redeem his people. That's how people are redeemed, through what Jesus did. And what he does is he brings perfect obedience to the law. He fulfills the covenant of works. The very fact that there is a covenant of grace demonstrates the need to uphold the righteous character of God. So we want to say that the covenant of grace fulfills the covenant of works, or the law covenant. That's what it does. The fruit of Christ's work doesn't change the law, does it? The fruit of what Jesus does, all of his obedience to the law, that doesn't change the law. Rather, the sinner is changed by what Jesus does. See, Jesus doesn't come and abrogate the law. Rather, he comes and he changes the sinner so the sinner can then begin to adhere to the law. That's why we are conformed into his image. That's why we're following what Christ has done, to be conformed to the image of his Son. So the fruit of what Jesus does doesn't change the law, it changes the sinner. Right? Jesus comes to fulfill the law. Matthew chapter 5, verse 17. Do not think that I came to destroy the law of the prophets. I did not come to destroy, but to fulfill. That's what he does. Matthew 5:17. Colossians chapter 1 and verse 13. He has delivered us from the power of darkness and conveyed us into the kingdom of the Son of his love. Right? Isn't that what he does? He takes us from one place and puts us in the other. It's not the law that changes. Instead, it's the sinner that is changed by what Christ does and what's imputed to him. And again, just so that we understand and don't confuse it, God never changes. And we write that under the gospel point. The law does not change because God does not change. Now, if you understand that, then you'll really understand why, in many places all through the scriptures, that God actually says what he says. You know, why does he say, why is Pelagius having a problem with, God tells me to do something, I can't do it because supposedly I'm falling according to what you're saying, Augustine. You know, that just doesn't make any sense to me. Why is that true? If we understand that God speaks to men just as though he's still speaking to Adam. If you remember that, because God doesn't change, because God's law doesn't change, when he speaks to men, he'll still require of them the same thing that he required of an unfallen Adam in the garden. He says to fallen sinners, do this and live. That's what he does. If fallen sinners are fallen, it doesn't matter if they're fallen. God doesn't change his law because they fall. So he just goes right on speaking, just the way that he's always been speaking, just the way that he talked with Adam, and he doesn't accommodate himself to the fallenness of man in that capacity. Rather, he sends Christ to save them. Now, the only thing really that was abrogated on the part of God was that man can no longer obtain eternal life by keeping the law. He can't do it. He doesn't have the ability to do it. That's really more of a consequence than any kind of abrogation of anything or removing. It's just a consequence of what's going on. He can't do it now. Now what happens? So there's a renewed statement over and over and over and over and over again, all through the scriptures, of man's condition. Right? That's why total depravity is key in understanding after the fall what Jesus does. Because if you really don't understand how fallen somebody is, then you're not really going to understand. I mean, if you don't understand the covenant of works, see how this all just like totally fits together? I mean, Augustine was teaching this. Irenaeus was teaching this back in the early church. I mean, this isn't something that somebody, you know, invented as a result of, you know, after the Reformation and the Puritans and that kind of stuff. This is old stuff. I mean, the city of God and the city of man. This is the covenant of works and the covenant of grace. That's what's going on. So, you know, this stuff isn't like brand new. This is stuff people are pulling out of their hat. This is what the church has been teaching, and it got lost. Because once Rome came in, I mean, you had all of this covering up of, rather, instead of a covenant of works and a covenant of grace, you had a covenant of works and a covenant of works, just in a different way, that men are supposed to fulfill in order to be saved. So the Reformation really rescued it, and then it came to light more because it set, you know, if you have something that's like two tones less than black, that's a little less black than black, and you put it in front of black, you can't really see it still because, you know, it looks the same. But if you take that two tone less than black and you put it in front of white, then it pops right out. And you go, oh, yeah, well, obviously that's what the case is. That's what the Reformation did. You know, it put it against this backdrop of the truth. And so the Roman Catholic Church, they just saw the difference between the two very clearly. So it was just more pronounced at that time because the Roman Church was there. But Augustine was teaching the same thing. These guys weren't teaching anything differently.
It's just that the Catholics perverted it so far, but then it
Correct.
Came out such a big thing.
Right. Right. It came out seeming like such a big thing later. And Deuteronomy 30, 9 and 10 says this, "The Lord your God will make you abound in all the work of your hand, and the fruit of your body, and the increase of your livestock, and the produce of your land for good. For the Lord will again rejoice over you for good as he rejoiced over your fathers, if you obey the voice of the Lord your God, to keep his commandments and his statutes which are written in the book of the law, and if you turn to the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul." It's conditional. The problem is that a lot of people even mess up, we're going to find out, the covenant of grace, because they think that the covenant of grace is not conditional. It's completely conditional. If somebody wants to be in the covenant of grace, they have to perfectly keep the law. That's how it works. That's why Jesus comes and he keeps the law for us. And so the condition then is faith in him. And how do we get it? Well, he has to regenerate us. But all of those things are still part and parcel of it. Sometimes people lean so far over to the other side. There's this book I've got to read for school called God's Everlasting Covenant of Grace. I haven't even got 20 pages into it. It's a terrible book. And I think they're having me read it on purpose because it is a terrible book. It's a total aberration of messing up the covenant of grace with the covenant of redemption, something that we're going to find out what those things are, see how all of that works. They're messing up conditions in the covenant and election, because they're two different things. Jesus fulfills everything for us. They're messing that up. They're thinking that when somebody says, well, there's a condition to get into the covenant of grace, they think that that's a wrong thing. They say, no, 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 it's only by sovereign grace God has to save us. They're missing lots of different points along the way, and they're combining other things. That is still a mess up of understanding what the covenant of works is all about. People don't get what Jesus comes to do because they don't get what this is. If they understand this, this doesn't change. Covenant doesn't change. This is a mutual agreement, remember, between two parties. The covenant never changes. The definition of covenant never changes. Even when we get into the covenant of redemption, even when we get into the covenant of grace, that's not going to change. There are going to be certain things along the way, though, that are going to help us, fallen sinners, be saved and fulfill those conditions through grace. And that's how all of that works together. We are regenerated. We can't do that on our own. We are saved. We can't do that on our own. We are given the ability to have faith. We can't do that on our own. All of that's totally sovereign grace. That's how it works. John 7:19. Did not Moses give you the law? Yet none of you keeps the law, Jesus says to them. Or James 2:10. Whoever shall keep the whole law and yet stumble in only one point, he's guilty of all. Right? Isn't that what he says? So all through the Bible, you have this renewal, these renewed statements about the failure to keep the covenant of works. God continually tells you that. You have to have the bad news in order to understand the good news. You have to have that. You can't just simply say, man fell, and so now Jesus comes to save us. If you don't understand, you know, when you deal with the gospel, that's why you want to deal with the character of God. He's holy. You're not. God requires perfect obedience. You can't. All of those things are part and parcel of bringing out the gospel message. You can't just say, hey, man is a sinner. People don't have a conception. Just like we talked the other day with Jim, you know, he's talking about people will come that don't understand justification. They don't know what that is. A lot of people don't really understand what sin is. They don't understand what a sinner is. Why is a sinner a sinner? You know, what does it mean that God's holy? How does all of that work together? So really the only thing that we see all through the scriptures is just the realization that man is now not able to keep covenant with God. He can't do it, even though there are conditions. Even though it is do this and live, and you will live, that he can't do this anymore. It's impossible for him to do it. So the answer to then that God gives that is Christ comes and he sends a mediator, and that's where we begin with the covenant of grace that way. Now, I think that Whitsia sets it up very well because, see, the first thing we didn't talk about was not the covenant of redemption before time. We didn't talk about that. The reason that we didn't talk about that first, that we talked about the covenant of works first, is because when we open our Bibles, that's the first one that pops out at us. Okay, that's the first one in dealing with men that pops out, is that God is talking first about that. When we get into this next part in Genesis 3:15, where the covenant of grace begins, right, line of the woman, line of the serpent, God's going to do something where the seed of the woman is going to crush the head of the serpent, and that covenant of grace comes in, at that point, we're going to start talking about how that's all going to work for our good and how that overthrows or overshadows anything that we can do in trying to merit our own salvation, and that God has supplied us with the means for us to be saved in him and through grace. That doesn't mean that the law covenant isn't supposed to be upheld. The covenant of works still has to be fulfilled, but that's what Jesus does. And he does it for us, and that's why we go back to imputation. Adam represented people. Jesus represented people. And all of that's going to make sense now that we understand the problem. You have to understand the problem first. So you go through the covenant of works, and then later you make a pause. And you say, okay, now let's talk about the covenant of redemption. What did God do to plan out the coming of a mediator as a result of the failure and fallenness of man? What is God going to do that's going to fulfill the law for man? What is he going to do to save sinners? What is he going to do? So that's why the order of these covenants, that's why we went in this particular order. We deal with the bad news first. And then we deal with the good news all together. So the next thing that we'll talk about is some introductory ideas. Now we'll talk about the covenant of redemption between the Father and the Son and what God did to redeem positively his bride. And so we'll stop there and pick it up with the good stuff, the good news, now, next time.
This Reformation audio track is a production of Stillwater's Revival Books. SWRB makes thousands of classic Reformation resources available, free and for sale, in audio, video, and printed formats. Our many free resources, as well as our complete mail order catalog, containing thousands of classic and contemporary Puritan and Reform books, tapes, and videos at great discounts, is on the web at www.swrb.com. We can also be reached by email at swrb@swrb.com, by phone at 780-450-3730, by fax at 780-468-1096, or by mail at 4710-37A Avenue, Edmonton, that's E-D-M-O-N-T-O-N, Alberta, abbreviated capital A, capital B, Canada, T6L3T5. You may also request a free printed catalog. And remember that John Calvin, in defending the Reformation's regulative principle of worship, or what is sometimes called the scriptural law of worship, commenting on the words of God, "which I commanded them not, neither came into my heart," from his commentary on Jeremiah 7:31, writes, "God here cuts off from men every occasion for making evasions, since he condemns by this one phrase, 'I have not commanded them,' whatever the Jews devised. There is then no other argument needed to condemn superstitions than that they are not commanded by God. For when men allow themselves to worship God according to their own fancies, and attend not to his commands, they pervert true religion. And if this principle was adopted by the papists, all those fictitious modes of worship in which they absurdly exercise themselves would fall to the ground. It is indeed a horrible thing for the papists to seek to discharge their duties towards God by performing their own superstitions. There is an immense number of them, as it is well known, and as it manifestly appears. Were they to admit this principle, that we cannot rightly worship God except by obeying his word, they would be delivered from their deep abyss of error. The prophet's words, then, are very important, when he says that God had commanded no such thing, and that it never came to his mind, as though he had said that men assume too much wisdom when they devise what he never required, nay, what he never knew."